The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is David Field. I am indeed privileged to have the honor of introducing our guest speaker this evening. Thank you all for coming for what promises to be a very special evening. Now, before we start, a brief commercial message for this extraordinary institution at which we are gathered at tonight. For those of you who have not explored the Free Library in a while, I encourage you to discover all the library has to offer in addition to the wonderful author event series. For the history buffs and armchair explorers in the audience, freelibrary.org features searchable digital versions of many historic maps in the library's collection, including atlases dating back to 1843, allowing you to see, for example, how the city of Philadelphia has grown and changed over time. Exploring the extraordinary treasures and resources of the Free Library might be a tad tamer than some of Theodore Roosevelt's adventures, but it still makes for a fascinating and edifying journey. On to our program. Edmund Morris is truly one of the great historians and biographers of our time. Born and raised in Kenya, he attended college in South Africa and then worked as an advertising copywriter in London before emigrating to the United States in 1968. In 1980, he completed his first book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, which won a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. Not a bad start. Mr. Morris then proceeded to torture all of us who were utterly captivated by his debut work, making us wait a full 22 years for the sequel. Theodore Roosevelt's White House years. And, of course, in the interim, Morris became President Reagan's official biographer, producing the national bestseller, Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan. And, of course, tonight we gather to hear him discuss his latest work, the third and final volume on TR, Colonel Roosevelt. On a personal note, I am a great fan of both Edmund Morris and Theodore Roosevelt, as I am sure are so many of you here this evening. For those of you who have not had the pleasure of enjoying this remarkable trilogy, I can only say from my own experience that you are missing a great, great treat. Edmund Morris has a great gift for bringing history to life and enthralling us with his exquisite storytelling, his masterful use of language, and his impeccable scholarship. And, of course, Theodore Roosevelt belongs on anyone's list of the most extraordinary and fascinating Americans. A Renaissance man on steroids, his prodigious accomplishments and epic adventures truly boggle the mind. Colonel Roosevelt has received great praise from the critics, including the following thoughts from Janet Maslin of the New York Times. Now with Colonel Roosevelt, the magnum opus is complete. It deserves to stand as the definitive study of its restless, mutable, ever-boyish, erudite, and tirelessly energetic subject. Mr. Morris has addressed the toughest and most frustrating part of Roosevelt's life with the same care and precision that he brought to the two earlier installments. And if this story of a lifetime is his own life's work, he has reason to be immensely proud. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Edmund Morris.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I just discovered I don't have a watch, so after I've gone on for 35 minutes, could somebody tell me to shut up? I have feelings of deja vu because I remember being here, it seems like yesterday, but I think it must have been in 2001 when I published my biography of Theodore Roosevelt. Unless I was here talking about Beethoven in 2005, the mind begins to blur. People seem to think it's rather weird that the authorized biographer of Ronald Reagan should write a book about Beethoven, but I always thought the connection was obvious. They were both deaf. And people also think it weird that the biographer of Beethoven and Theodore Roosevelt should write about Reagan, but actually Reagan and Roosevelt had more in common than you might think. In fact, after I'd finished my first book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, which was published in 1980, I began work on the sequel, which was about his presidency, Theodore Rex, and made very heavy weather of it because I frankly didn't know all that much about the presidency when I began to write it. The previous book had been the story of a young man's rise to power, which any writer can handle, but to write about the White House, to write about Theodore Roosevelt having two terms as president in the early years of the 20th century required more knowledge than I actually had about how Washington worked, how the White House functioned. So it was something of a godsend to me when I became Reagan's biographer because although I had to put the manuscript of Theodore Rex aside, being Reagan's biographer, being in the White House and observing the president in action, interviewing him and interviewing his staff and his family and his associates, I achieved a working knowledge of how the White House functions to such an extent that that it was actually to the benefit of the future book that I was going to write about TR, that I had spent all those years studying Reagan. Even so, in the White House, amid all the drama and the extraordinary excitement of power actually happening before my eyes, I still had a lingering nostalgia for the president I'd put aside. Having started to write about TR and having been infected with the hypnotic interest of his personality, it was somewhat difficult to set him aside and concentrate on what President Reagan was doing. I remember one morning staff meeting in the Roosevelt room, ironically, a rather boring meeting at which I found myself beginning to drift off, and I found myself doodling a few paragraphs for Theodore Rex on my yellow legal pad. And at the end of the meeting, I was walking off down the corridor toward the president's office. I think I had an interview with him that day. And a young staffer ran after me saying, "Mr. Morris, you left your notes." I said, "Oh, thank you." She said, "Sir, you ought to be more careful about national security." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, it says here the president's plotting a revolution in Panama." So I realized then no biographer can serve two masters, and I put that book aside and spent the next 10 or 12 years writing about Reagan. Came back to Theodore Rex and finished it. I hoped to publish that book on September the 15th, 2001, because September the 15th, 2001 would have been the centennial of the day TR became president after the death of the assassinated President McKinley. As it happened, I was late delivering the manuscript, and Random House had to delay publication until November of 2001, which was another stroke of good luck, because if I had published on September the 15th, 2001, 4 days after 9/11, you can imagine the book would have sold about 12 copies. We were that distracted. And as it happened, by November, the country was beginning to need, or at least the reading public was beginning to need, a book about a president who, in times of crisis, was a force for articulate American decency and passion. Well, having finished Theodore Rex, with the rather moving spectacle of this 50-year-old man still in the full possession of all his faculties, giving up power, leaving the White House, handing over power to President Taft, his hand-picked successor, I was aware that the book that would tell the rest of his life was going to have to be something quite different from that covering the presidency. He lived another 10 years, which presupposed a pretty substantial volume, probably even bigger than Theodore Rex, because it was a story that would have to encompass a dazzling variety of experiences and adventures culminating in the great crisis of World War I. The book had to begin, and did begin, with the story of his historic safari through what was then called British East Africa in the spring of 1909. Within a month of leaving the White House, he was in Africa sitting on the cow catcher of an East African railroad locomotive, ascending up from Mombasa onto the plains of Kapiti to begin a year-long safari through the countryside where I was born and grew up. Now, as a Kenya schoolboy, about the age of this young man here, I became aware of Theodore Roosevelt for the first time. Nairobi was then 50 years old, and it celebrated its 50-year anniversary with a booklet about its history, filled with articles about famous people who'd come to Nairobi in the past, and one of them was ex-President Theodore Roosevelt in 1909. So here am I, 10 years old, flicking through this book, and I came across this photograph of this famous American wearing a pith helmet and with a ragged mustache and the superabundance of teeth, grinning at the camera. By the way, I always think of a line from one of Somerset Maugham's stories when I see pictures of T.R. grinning, one of the Ashendon stories. He had rather more teeth than seemed necessary for any practical purpose. Anyway, here was this grinning American in his pith helmet. And something about that picture spoke to me as a small boy. I suppose the way Senator Kerry spoke to you. And I don't know what it was about him, but he seemed like fun. It was a momentary impression. I forgot about him after that, and it wasn't until 25 years later, living here in the United States as a young immigrant, hungrily looking around for work, to anything that would pay the rent. I was watching TV when Richard Nixon resigned the presidency in 1975 and began in his farewell speech, for reasons best known to himself, to quote a rather poignant little eulogy that Theodore Roosevelt had written in 1884. Nixon, I guess many of you saw this on television, Nixon began to sob and said, "I want to read something to you that Teddy Roosevelt wrote when he was young." And he read, "She was beautiful in face and form. There had never come to her any great sorrow. As a fair young flower she lived, and as a fair flower she died." And I remember thinking, what's this got to do with resigning the presidency of the United States? But it obviously was a text that meant something very fundamental to Nixon. And indeed, when I checked up on it, it turned out that Theodore Roosevelt was writing about the death of his beautiful young wife, Alice Hathaway Lee, on Valentine's Day, 1884. The tragedy, coupled with that of his own mother, who died in the same house on the same night, the tragedy that drove him west to become a ranchman, to recover from this double bereavement and repair his body and soul. That was the spark. That was the narrative that caught my imagination, revived in my head that image of the grinning president from childhood. And I began to write a screenplay, which eventually mutated into my first book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt. So here am I now writing volume 3, a quarter of a century later, telling the story of Theodore Roosevelt's visit to the land where I was born. And in researching that safari, discovered that he had lived, when he was in Nairobi, he periodically came into Nairobi at intervals during his great safari for equipment and mail and stuff like that. I found that when he was in Nairobi, he would stay in the house of Sir William Northrop Macmillan, which was directly across the river from where I grew up. In fact, as a kid, I used to cross the river and go into this very unkempt plantation where Sir William's widow lived, Lady Macmillan. I used to squeeze through the bamboo forest and peek through into her garden, and I would see this very old lady sitting on the veranda with servants in white kanzas waiting on her. And if it had been only 40 years before, I probably would have seen Theodore Roosevelt sitting on that same veranda writing the first chapters of his book, African Game Trails. Anyway, the book begins with a story of that great safari, which was undertaken in behalf of the Smithsonian Institution. It was a specimen-gathering safari. Still, I believe, the greatest, most elaborate safari ever held in East Africa. And it lasted more than a year. A year in which the former president of the United States had virtually no contact whatsoever with the outside world. Darkest Africa in those days really was dark. Most of the country he hunted in was primal wilderness. And it really wasn't until the following spring when he came down the River Nile and arrived in Khartoum that he discovered a phalanx of newspaper reporters and messengers from foreign heads of state waiting for him, the reporters wanting to know, was he going to come back to the United States pronto and run again for the presidency because of the mess that President Taft was making of policy? Or the messengers wanted to know, would the former president consent to visit Europe, to make a grand tour of all the countries of Europe? Because all the kings and the emperors and the potentates of Europe were wanting TR to come and stay, to stay in their palaces and meet their families and visit their universities and review their armies. Because during this year of total absence from the world scene, the master showman, Theodore Roosevelt, had pulled off his most dramatic act yet. He had absented himself to such an extent that he had, in his absence, become the most famous man in the world. So he found that he had to accept these invitations, and the first two or three chapters of my book, following the prologue, tell the story of this grand, grand tour of Europe. By the way, the sixth grand tour that he'd accomplished in that continent. He was the most well-traveled of all our presidents, even before he became president. Two grand tours of Europe and the Middle East when he was still a boy. 6 months in Germany, studying German lyric poetry and learning the language as a teenager. Two more grand tours of Europe. By the way, they all lasted a year or half a year each before he became president. So by the time he became president, he had amassed an extraordinary wealth of personal acquaintance. He knew all the British aristocratic families, all the parliamentarians. He knew three languages. He spoke and read in French and German. He could also read Italian, although he couldn't speak it. He had friends extending as far away as Japan and Brazil, an enormous circle of acquaintance and correspondence. He read, on average, a book a day, turning over the pages at the rate of 3 or 4 pages a minute, and mentally photographing the contents in his photographic memory. To give you just one example of his cosmopolitanism and his memory, in the book I describe his visit to when he was in Cairo, just before his grand tour began, his visit to Al-Azhar Mosque in Cairo, which is the world's oldest university. He showed up there to find the mullahs teaching madras to all these young Egyptian students sitting on the floor. And he asked if they would be so good as to show him, if they had it in their library, a scroll of the medieval travels of Ibn Battuta, the famous Arabic explorer of the Middle Ages. You can imagine the astonishment and the delight of the mullahs as they scurried off to the library, and they came back with a scroll in Arabic, by which time T.R. was already reciting the opening pages of that book. He said, of course, I never read it in Arabic, you understand, but I did read it in French a number of years ago, and I remember it very well. Now, what other president can you think of capable of that kind of intellectual and cultural reach? Anyway, so he began his tour of Europe. He found himself dining with the King of Italy and the Queen of Italy, the Emperor of Austria, old Franz Joseph, who said to him, I believe you have killed something like 292 large animals in Africa, Mr. Roosevelt. I myself, in my life, have killed 50,000. He also said to T.R., you embody the future. I embody the old order, and yours is the years to come. Wherever he went, as he proceeded through Hungary and France and Belgium and Holland and Norway and Sweden and Germany, wherever he went, staying with these emperors, he saw and felt coming the enormous catastrophe, the coming catastrophe of World War I. It came upon him with particular vividness when he was sitting on a horse beside Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany in May, early May 1910, sitting on a pair of gray war horses, looking out over the field of Döberitz and seeing the German Wehrmacht, the army, at its exercises. And after he saw this great military machine, this field green machine, sweeping in wave after wave after wave across the plain, he became uncharacteristically depressed and said to his wife that night, we are in for it. I've seen it coming. And there is no way the United States can not be involved in this war which is going to engulf all of Europe. That was May of 1910, a month in which, by the typical cosmic coincidences that make the life of Theodore Roosevelt so extraordinarily dramatic, in which King Edward VII died, causing President Taft to appoint his predecessor, a special ambassador representing the United States at the funeral of the dead king. And so it was in the third week of May 1910, T.R. arrived in London and found himself walking down Whitehall in his black American Republican suit and top hat, surrounded by all the potentates he'd recently been staying with and gotten to know, all the heads of state who in a few short years would be at war with one another. The last great pageant of 19th century imperial power. And in the midst of it, this Republican American. Still only 51 years old, by universal consent amongst Europeans and indeed amongst many Americans, likely to be president once again, there he was with all of them around him. And the mere fact that he was there, that he had this relationship with them all and understood Europe so well, encourages me to speculate, although I don't much like historical speculation, but what if T.R. had indeed been elected president in 1912 instead of being defeated by Woodrow Wilson? What if he had been in the White House when that war broke out in August of 1914. We must remember that not only was he, as I've emphasized, a complete cosmopolitan, intimately acquainted with all the dramatis personae of the war, he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner by virtue of his mediation of the Russo-Japanese War in 1905-6, and a diplomat of extraordinary skill. He would have been in the White House, and I think it almost unquestionable that the powers that were would have turned to him, as they had in 1905, to mediate a resolution of the tensions engulfing Europe. Maybe the war was inevitable. Historically, it seems that it was. It was a sweeping way of the old order. Maybe it would have broken out, but I think if he had been president, he would almost certainly have been able to bring it to a conclusion much sooner than it did. But history is history, facts are facts, and Woodrow Wilson, this parochial Presbyterian, whose foreign travels amounted to two bicycling tours of Britain and a couple of trips to Bermuda, a man who had absolutely no interest in the outside world at all, he, by ironic turn of fate, was president in 1912, and T.R. was not. One cannot help seeing the hand of fate in T.R.'s failure to win election again in 1912. It was a quixotic campaign that he himself, strangely enough, did not want to undertake. When he got back from Europe, to the greatest welcome New York had ever extended to a returning son, the greatest parade of its kind until Lindbergh came back in the late 1920s. When he came back, all he wanted to do was spend the rest of his life writing and reading. He was a genuine intellectual, as I hope my book makes clear. He was a cerebral person who loved scholarship, the author of many books. 40 was his lifetime total, but he'd written naval histories, military histories, biographies, nature writings, political analysis, literary criticism, and tons of other titles. He wanted to become a man of letters. However, as president, he had willy-nilly become the spiritual leader of the progressive movement developing in this country. And when he came back in 1910, the progressives, this white, middle-class, grassroots movement, was becoming daily more and more passionate and more and more desirous of participatory politics. They wanted him to become their leader and represent them in the presidential campaign of 1912. So more or less as out of a sense of debt to them, he did agree to run, and he competed for the Republican nomination, was narrowly defeated by President Taft, because in those days the party nominations were still controlled by orthodox machinery. So T.R. was more or less forced to bolt the Republican Party and form the famous Progressive Party, with a capital P, the Bull Moose Party, and campaign on the progressive agenda, an agenda of social reform so radical for its time that many of the planks in his platform did not achieve realization until the time of his fifth cousin, Franklin Roosevelt. I spoke just now about fate intervening to prevent his re-election, because on October the 14th of that year, at the height of his campaign, he was speaking in Milwaukee, or at least he had an engagement to speak in Milwaukee after dinner, came out of his hotel room, and in a series of events uncannily similar to the attack on Ronald Reagan in March of 1981, he emerged from his hotel. His limousine was waiting for him. His Secret Service guys were on either side. A small crowd was collected in the street. They cheered as he appeared, and he began to wave to them as he climbed into his limo. And as he waved, a short, pale-eyed, blonde young man stepped forward, popped off a shot at point-blank range. The bullet went through TR's heavy overcoat, his jacket, into his waistcoat, his vest, smacked into his 50-page speech that he had folded up. That makes 100 pages since it was double-folded. There's a photograph of the speech in my book, by the way, with the perforations showing. It also, the bullet also hit his steel-lined spectacle case, smashed through that, went through his shirt, and impacted on his rib. In a trajectory which, if the rib had not been in the way, if all these impedimenta had not been in the way, would have gone straight into his heart and he would have been dead before he sat down. Well, being by nature a consummate showman, he declined to go to hospital, even though he could feel blood spreading on his shirt front, insisted on being driven to the Milwaukee auditorium, and got one of his representatives to step out ahead of him to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Roosevelt has been shot, but he does want to speak to you tonight. And he's all right." So that got their attention. Out he came, tottering slightly, looking rather grave-faced, and extracted from his pocket the 50-page speech. And it was only when he saw the perforations through the speech that he really realized what had happened. He was aware that he'd been shot, but something about those perforations struck him so violently that he tottered on his feet again, and they were rather afraid he might fall into the audience. But he recovered and he opened his shirt front, his coat, to expose this great spreading mass of blood, and he shrieked in his high falsetto voice, "It takes more than that to kill a bull moose." Always the showman. Ronald Reagan would have done exactly the same. In fact, a lot of parallels between the two. They both, when they got to hospital, joked with their doctors and, anyway, made theater of what might have been a tragedy. He recovered, but he carried that bullet in his breast for the rest of his life. He lost the campaign narrowly to Woodrow Wilson. And the rest of the book concerns his post-political career. One of the things he did to recover from his defeat in 1912, having written a few books in the winter, including his autobiography, was to go off to Brazil and explore a tributary of the Amazon called the Rio da Dúvida, the unknown river, the river of doubt. He explored it at the request of the Brazilian government because they were not entirely sure if it was indeed a tributary of the Amazon. They just knew that it sprung somewhere up in Mato Grosso, and they offered Colonel Roosevelt the privilege and the financing of exploring this river if he wanted to do it. To be accompanied by a Brazilian army colonel, Colonel Rondon, and TR could not resist the opportunity, as he put it, to be a boy again. And that began this historic expedition in the early months of 1914, which very nearly brought about his death. It was a horrendous journey, during which he suffered so much from malnutrition and malaria and abscesses and heart problems that he reached the point of death and begged his son, who was on the expedition with him, and his colleagues to let him die and go back to civilization themselves. They, of course, declined. He was the most famous man in the world still, and they wouldn't hear of leaving him. There's another picture in the book, rather poignant one, of TR standing in the lower reaches of the Rio da Dúvida, looking emaciated, scarcely strong enough to stand, while Colonel Rondon reads in Portuguese, this proclamation renaming the Rio da Dúvida the Rio Roosevelt, which is still its name today, a thousand-mile river longer than the Rhine, named after him, but the Brazilians prefer to call it, they can't pronounce Roosevelt too easily, they prefer to call it Rio Teodoro, Teddy's River. By the time he got back to the United States, a physical ruin, he never quite recovered from the effects of that expedition for the rest of his life. The war was just about beginning, and Woodrow Wilson was in charge, and he had to face the future, had to accept the fact that he was not able to control the drift of events. At first, he supported Wilson's policy of neutrality and pacifism, but three incidents turned TR against Wilson and made him passionately determined to cajole Americans into their democratic duty to join in this war. One was the burning of the University of Louvain in Belgium by the Germans in the fall of 1914, the greatest library of medieval manuscripts in Europe, deliberately burned, an act of barbarism, followed very rapidly by the destruction of the Cathedral of Reims, which TR compared to the extermination of a species, and then the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915, with many Americans aboard. These three catastrophes made TR an evangelist for American participation in World War I, and the rest of my book is concerned with his epic confrontation with the president on that subject, and his evangelism, which finally bore fruit in public acceptance of the need to join in, to fight German militarism and the specter of fascism rising in Europe, which indeed was accomplished in the spring of 1917 when the United States did finally join the war. There is a pathetic scene in Colonel Roosevelt, pathetic and in a way majestic, of TR going to the White House shortly after the declaration of war and begging Woodrow Wilson, almost literally on his knees, to let him lead a division of American volunteers to the front to fight immediately in behalf of France and Britain while the United States was raising its professional army. But Wilson, quite rightly, denied him that privilege. He was 58 years old. His notion of war was romantic. Wilson understood that war had become absolute and mechanized and was a matter for great professional armies. It was no longer a matter of romantic cavalry charges. And the specter of a former president of the United States pathetically leading imaginary charges across the fields of Flanders was something that Wilson would not entertain. So TR had to accept his exclusion from the war. In his stead, he sent his four sons, exhibiting a rather sick desire that one or all of them might get wounded or perhaps even killed, and so uphold the family name, bring honor upon the family name. Well, he got what he wished. Quentin, the youngest of all his children, of all his six children, the one most like himself, the one most reluctant to go to war, was shot down in July of 1918. He's a fighter pilot, and killed instantly. And the effect of that calamity upon the aging TR was so overwhelming that it was a question of time when he himself would die of a broken heart, which indeed he did do on the Feast of the Epiphany, January the 6th, 1918. Ironically, if he'd lived, he was still only 60 years old. He would have been nominated in 1920 by the Republican Party, renominated for the presidency, and without question would have been re-elected president because there was that overwhelming Republican sweep in the fall of 1920, which gave us Warren Harding. However, I must confess, as his biographer, I'm rather glad he snuffed it when he did, because I wouldn't want to write another volume. And that concludes my general remarks this evening, ladies and gentlemen. I believe you're all professional questioners, so if any of you would like to hit me with some questions, I'd be happy to have a conversation with you. Thank you.
I was wondering if you might elaborate on the similarities you find between Ronald Reagan and T.R. beyond the reaction to the assassination attempt, because I find them pretty different people.
Oh, would I elaborate on the similarities between T.R. and R.R.? Yes, of course they were diametrically different people, but showmanship, they both had this extraordinary ability to turn personal charm into power. They both had exquisite senses of humor, and they both had an innate sense of timing. They knew how to orchestrate great events, how to present themselves, how to sense the mood of the moment. They had the psychology du fool. They understood the crowd. They both, in youth, were aspirant writers. T.R. spent the rest of his life writing, but Reagan, believe it or not, as a teenager, wrote more imaginatively and better than T.R. did. Some of his short stories, which I describe in Dutch, are really quite remarkable in their ability, their almost eerie ability to remember his own future. For example, one of them is about this high school fullback, star back, who is very attached to his coach. And when the coach gets sick and has to retire, the university is called New Domain, clearly based on Notre Dame. When this coach decides to retire because he's ailing, he calls the team together and he says, one of these days you guys are going to be in a match where everything goes against you. And in that time of crisis, you must remember, think of me, I'll be in the stands watching you. Reagan wrote this story in 1932, 8 years before he filmed the story of George Gipp, Win One for the Gipper. T.R. too, as a young writer, had a gift of remembering his own future. I was paging through his diary, for example, at Harvard, that he wrote, kept a diary all through his years at Harvard, documenting his love for Alice Hathaway Lee, which was brought to a consummation on the day of his graduation when he married Alice and went to spend his honeymoon night in Springfield, Massachusetts. So the beady-eyed biographer turns the page to see what it was like in bed with gorgeous Alice Lee. And he wrote, "Our sacred happiness is too private to be written about." And I had the distinct feeling of being addressed. In 1880, Theodore Roosevelt knew that one day some biographical voyeur was going to be going through his diaries because he knew he was going to be famous. Yes.
I've gotten to the point in your book where I'm reading about the progressive platform in 1912, and I'm sort of surprised at how all-embracing and ambitious it was, and thinking about how the Republican Party today claims to be against the idea of big government in every way, I can't help but think how you think TR would react to the degree we can think about it, what politics are like in 100 years later.
T.R. was a big government man. He believed in strong authoritarian executive power. He believed in the federal state. He was not a believer in individualism or states' rights. I think he would be more comfortable today as a Democrat. But he certainly was what later became called a liberal Republican. In his own day, he was called a progressive Republican. But some of the issues that he espoused, both as president and even more vociferously later on as a progressive candidate for the presidency, are issues which are particularly hot now. To mention just two, one is the conservation of national resources, natural resources, and the other is regulation of corporate, freelance corporate individualism. In particular, federal regulation of the banking industry. All through his life, and very particularly as president, T.R. had the greatest suspicion of banking institutions that operated beyond the reach of the federal government. Something in him reacted viscerally against the notion of secretive boardrooms, corporate plotting and planning that the government was not privy to. So a lot of his rhetoric in the Progressive Campaign of 1912 could be recycled today with practically no word needing to be changed. Yes, this lady.
I actually have a two-part question. One is, having read your book about his presidency, and whereas he was clearly more progressive for his age, he became much more progressive later on. So one of my questions is, what was his epiphany that made him so much more progressive as an older man than he was when he actually had an opportunity to do something about it when he was president? And my other question is, you mentioned how things might have been different if he had become elected in 1912 with regard to World War I. I was wondering how things, in your opinion, might have been different socially and progressively had he been elected at that time.
T.R. did not have a progressive epiphany. He had steadily become more and more progressive as soon as he was reelected, or should I say elected, in 1904. He inherited his first term from President McKinley. So his first real election was 1904. And having been triumphantly endorsed by the voting population, he revealed his progressive inclinations almost immediately and pushed through a raft of progressive legislation in 1906 and became steadily more progressive, more left-wing, to an almost socialistic extent as far as the guys in Wall Street were concerned, producing a special message in 1908, which was so left-wing, so radical, that it was seriously believed on Wall Street that he'd gone insane. It was not a joke. People thought that T.R. was crazy. I write about that in quite some detail in Theodore Rex. So his progressive apotheosis in 1912 was foreordained. However, after the great apotheosis of progressivism in 1912, he very quickly began to lose interest in the movement because it became too radical even for his own tastes. He disliked the fanaticism of men like Gifford Pinchot and Amos Pinchot in particular, writing Amos Pinchot a classic letter saying, "Dear sir, when I spoke of the progressive parties having a lunatic fringe, I had specifically you in mind." And by 1916, it was pretty clear that T.R. wanted to be welcomed back into the bosom of the Republican Party, and in fact did. He declined nomination from the Progressive Party in 1916, and by the time 1918 came around, T.R. was back full-time as an orthodox Republican and had lost a lot of his youthful radical fervor. As to what kind of presidency he would have presided over, in socially speaking, after 1912, I can only speculate that it would have faithfully brought about a lot of the reforms promised in that campaign, that platform of 1912, a remarkable document. I believe the most detailed and lengthy political platform ever published. And one can only assume that he would have remained faithful to it, because one thing about TR was he did keep his campaign promises, unlike some of his successors. Yes, sir. Yep, this gentleman here.
So I can't help but be intrigued by your comment before. It's World War I, and the von Schlieffen plan has not worked, and Plan 17 hasn't worked, and there's stalemate in Europe. We've got Verdun and the Battle of the Somme and the Battle of the Marne, and Roosevelt's president. What does he do?
Sir, I'm not going to venture any further into the boggy grounds of speculation, only to say that if he had been there, he would have been a substantial presence in world affairs. And if you study the diplomatic posturings of all the major contenders in World War I, Germany and Britain and France, it was quite plain all through the war that they were all privately longing for solutions. And they needed a great mediatory force. Here was the United States, an independent, neutral power, enormously wealthy and enormously influential. With an internationalist president like TR in place, one can't help but believe they would have turned to him to mediate their differences, as in fact they eventually turned to Woodrow Wilson. Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming again to the Free Library. I'd be interested in your thoughts as to whether TR was in fact a white supremacist and whether he in fact gave a green light to Japan to expand in Asia, ultimately leading to the Asian component of World War II.
I have an uncanny feeling you've been reading James Bradley's book. Well, let's talk. I'll try and be brief. TR's racial attitudes were, for his time, comparatively enlightened, which was not to say that he did not believe, as most men of his class did, that black Americans were inferior to whites, intellectually and socially. He, on the other hand, was different from friends of his like Henry Adams and Owen Wister in believing that black men of great personal worth were capable of rising to privilege, particularly Dr. Booker T. Washington. By virtue of his own industry and smarts, Dr. Washington had become the most powerful black leader in America, and TR admired him profoundly for having achieved what he did achieve, and frequently described him as one of the greatest men he'd ever known. However, he was on the whole patronizing in his attitude toward American blacks, and rather blotted his copybook in the single worst mistake of his presidency, and the incident of the Brownsville raid in 1906. Having started off magnificently in October of 1901 by inviting Booker T. Washington to have dinner with him in the White House, ardeur with his wife, in the intimacy of the private dining room, having made that splendid gesture, the first time any black man had been greeted with that kind of equality, he had to spoil things in his second term by dismissing dishonorably discharging an entire regiment of black soldiers in Brownsville, Texas, on clearly trumped-up charges of rioting. It was actually just the local white citizens wanting to get rid of this regiment. TR believed everything his army inspector of the general told him. He discharged these guys. He gave them no chance to defend themselves in court-martial. And even though he realized afterwards he'd made a horrible mistake, he never apologized and never withdrew it, losing overnight all the support he'd won amongst black Americans. In the progressive year of 1912, he had an agonizing decision to make as to whether this new party was going to admit southern black Americans into its membership. There was no question that black northern Americans were welcome and indeed did participate in the party. But TR decided to exclude southern blacks for complex reasons which he believed to be honorable. I go into that incident in quite a lot of detail in Colonel Roosevelt, and it's a little too complex for me to get in now, but it makes for hard reading today. With respect to James Bradley in Japan, I will only say that TR was aware right from the 1890s that Japan, a nation he profoundly admired, was a threat, a future threat to the security of the United States. He set a strategic question for the Naval War College in the early 1890s, which went something like this. Japan attacks the Hawaiian Islands. How does the United States respond? And throughout his presidency, with one side of his mouth, he praised the Japanese for their martial virtues, for the way they humiliated the Russian Empire in that war. But he was constantly aware that they posed a strategic threat to this country and governed his East Asian policies accordingly. Yes, sir.
Would you share a bit of your entertaining narrative about the libel suit that Roosevelt was forced to defend against one of the New York bosses who had played a role useful at times in his earlier political career?
Yeah, I've forgotten to mention there's two great trials, two great courtroom dramas in the story. You're talking about Barnes versus Roosevelt. T.R. badmouthed the leader of the boss of the Republican Party in New York State in 1912, calling him corrupt and a tool of the corporations, and a lot of other intolerable names. So Barnes quite justifiably sued him for libel, and T.R. had to go on trial in 1915. To prove that what he said was true, because if it was not true, he would have been guilty of libel and would have been financially ruined. I gather that legal opinion to this day holds that TR was actually guilty of libel in that case, although Barnes quite frankly admitted he did represent corporations and he did like to make money out of the state, but he did operate within the bounds of the law, and TR certainly spoke outside of the bounds of propriety. But his personality was so gigantic in the court that Barnes just didn't have a chance. At one point, the lawyer defending Barnes said to T.R., who was gesticulating in the witness box, "You needn't address me. I'm not a mass meeting." He said, "You're trying to eat me alive here. I'm just asking you questions." And the mesmerized jury, after 3 or 4 days of debate, acquitted T.R. It was a narrow escape. Yes, ma'am.
Would you share a little about your odyssey from Kenya to Britain to the United States, please?
Oh, well, ma'am, I'm an immigrant. I began a new life coming here in 1968, and I think of myself as more American than African now. In fact, I guess I'm an African-American. I grew up reading Mark Twain and identifying with Tom Sawyer and reading the Saturday Evening Post in the U.S. Information Service office in Nairobi, so I always loved America and wanted to live here. However, my education was British in the sense that all my teachers in Kenya were Oxbridge types. So I had that cultural attachment, which drew me to England first, but to live in Britain in the late 1960s was to want to get out of it pretty damn quick. It was a decaying socialistic state, liberal state, where personal ambition was frowned upon. And I came to the United States, having married my wife there, with the usual immigrant's dream of being lucky. As E.B. White wrote in Here is New York, nobody should come to New York unless he is prepared to be lucky. And like many immigrants, I succeeded in being very unlucky to begin with, but luck eventually comes, and I'm lucked into this subject, and here I am. Yes, ma'am. One more question.
All my questions about Roosevelt have been asked and answered, and I thank you. You have an intimate knowledge. the one thing that's, I don't know why it's in my mind, by what method did you cross that little river to peek through the bamboo at the old lady on the porch?
I waded. Okay. It was only about that wide. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.